Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Dr. Brian Bowdle, who is a psychology professor here at Grand Valley State University. This all stemmed from a conversation we had at his home a few months ago when he asked me if I'd ever heard of the book The Birth and Death of Meaning by Ernest Becker. I said, "Why, no, Brian, I have not." And he said, "Here, take this book and read it. I think you'd like it." Well, books about meaning and the meaning of life, etc., always had a special place in my heart. So I did, and I contacted him later. I said, "You know, I think this is worthy of a program." So last week we gathered here in the studio, and we are gathering once again here in the studios at WGVU to talk more about the birth and death and meaning. Welcome once again to Common Threads, Brian.
Thank you for having me back.
Certainly. Let's not regurgitate too much of last week's show. So if they missed it, they can always get it online. Okay. So let's start afresh. And let's have a brief conversation on the collective meaning, on cultural meaning, all right? Because clearly we have either invented meaning individually, mm-hmm. or there truly is meaning and we've latched on to it. And there's also a collective, a cultural sense of meaning.
Right.
How does Becker discuss that? And do you fall in line with what he says on it?
Right. Starting with the first question, it seems like it ought to be a simple question to answer because so many of the ideas in this book are really simple when you get right down to it. But trying to explain it sometimes is not the simplest thing. Again, as I mentioned last time, the two big questions that Becker was really trying to address in this book are, number one, why do we crave self-esteem? And number two, why do we cling to our cultural belief systems, our ideological systems, so much, even to the extent that sometimes this makes us treat groups with different beliefs quite aggressively, become quite dangerous to them. And the answer to both of these questions really has to do with Becker's idea that because of our ability to conceive of the world around us as being full of meaning and at the same time our worry about our mortality, these big existential ideas and concerns, and again, our concern, our suspicion, perhaps maybe not fully conscious that perhaps things really aren't all that meaningful, including our own lives. Maybe we're just basically smart animals and nothing more. Culture comes in to fill some of these voids. Culture becomes a defense mechanism. It's maybe not the reason that cultures evolve, societies evolve. Certainly there are many benefits to living in a group of people. When we can cooperate with others, our chances of survival are increased exponentially. We can do things together that we can't do individually. We really are a social species, and we rely on others for support, for nurturance, to learn how to do things in different environments. But Becker began to take all of this to yet another level, an existential level, and say, look, what cultures really do is they provide us with these tremendous symbolic buffers against these existential anxieties. Number one, cultures give us a sense of meaning. Cultural systems, belief systems, give us a sense of what is true and what is false, what is valued and what is not. They basically provide us with ways, prescribed ways, of achieving what he calls heroism in our own lives, feeling like we do have, in fact, have meaning and purpose, that we are objects of primary value, so to speak. Different cultures, of course, will have different systems of values and rituals and traditions that are going to suggest different occupations, different practices, perhaps different possessions are things that can confer value and self-esteem and meaningfulness. But every culture basically provides, ideally, the people that live in that culture with a sense of meaning and truth.
And there are some cultures, my experience is that there are some cultures who may value A, B, and C, mm-hmm. and say that D, E, and F are wrong values.
Yes.
And then there are others who say we value A, B, and C, but D, E, and F for those people is just fine.
Yes. That's right. Different cultures are going to emphasize different things, oftentimes contradictory things. And sometimes even within a culture, depending on how free that culture is, given individuals will disagree with other individuals on what is true and meaningful and worthy versus what is illusory or even offensive or what have you.
But even those are active subcultures.
Yes.
So they're still providing.
They're still cultures.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. It's funny, you know, when you look at various countercultural movements, and everybody in the movement, of course, is saying, you know, oh, I stand outside of society and I'm an individual. But then you look at the people they surround themselves with, and oftentimes they're wearing exactly the same countercultural uniforms and listening to the same music and so on and so forth. And so, yes, there's conformity even within nonconformist groups, so to speak. Absolutely. Absolutely. So cultures provide a sense of meaning and value, give us ways of achieving self-esteem. But also, according to Becker, cultures can give us what he calls ways of engaging in immortality projects. This is a concept that doesn't come up as much in this book, but did come up quite a bit in his next book, The Denial of Death. It was published 2 years later in 1973. And in that book, he focuses much more on the fear of death, on the fear of mortality, and says basically what we're all striving to do in order to deny our animal natures and also in order to deny the sense that, you know, all the things we've accomplished in our lives, wanting to believe they're meaningful, will eventually just come to naught, that it'll be meaningless because we'll pass away. We want to convince ourselves that indeed, after our physical deaths, we will continue to live on forever. And there are a number of different ways that that can be accomplished. Excuse me. Many of them are symbolic. We can achieve symbolic immortality. So, for instance, you can write the great American novel, and then everyone will be talking about you forever after. Or if you're a scientist, you can make a great discovery, write a tremendous paper that will forever influence your field. You can do
progeny.
Something. Yeah, exactly. Progeny is a great example. You will live on forever and the memories of your children and their children and their children, and not just through photo albums, but through stories of the amazing and the funny things that you did and your values and so on and so forth. Or even to the extent that you wrap yourself up in your culture very, very tightly. If you believe that your culture, your nation, for instance, is the greatest nation on the face of the planet and will live on forever in the face of all adversity, and you have contributed to that culture, then you will live on forever. Other immortality projects more closely tied to religion are quite literal in nature. Many different great religions say if you believe these things, if you live a life of this kind, you will in fact go to a better place after you die and will achieve immortality in paradise, for instance.
I'm not sure if you're aware, in Judaism you have many different options for mm-hmm. believing in afterlife. And what you described, living on through your works, through your life, and through your children's lives and children's children's lives,
yes,
is accepted in many circles.
Yes.
That's the best you can expect. The idea of a soul surviving the body and going to some better place or worse place, it just doesn't play into it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say most religions certainly follow that idea, that there is this soul that survives the body, mm-hmm. and although there are a variety of theories of what happens to that soul, nonetheless, it does live on and usually is immortal.
Yes, exactly. Now, of course, you know, different cultures, different religions have different ways of conceiving that. But this is where things get difficult in this book. On the one hand, Becker's saying we all need meaning. Meaning gives us a sense of hope. We need it to sustain ourselves. It's the most important thing we can achieve is a sense of meaning and heroism. You know, that kind of self-esteem that we really are. It's not just that our lives are meaningful stories, not just that we are the central characters in these meaningful stories that are our lives, but we're the protagonist of our life story. That is super important. But if you line up any two cultures or any dozen cultures, you won't find much of any agreement, you know, across everything in terms of what is most valuable, what is the truth, because different cultures have different religious beliefs. They have different forms of government, different views on politics, different economic systems, different rituals, different In many cases, moral values, aside from the universal ones of, you know, don't kill and don't steal, but different sets of moral values, different hierarchies in terms of occupations. To assume that your own culture has a stranglehold on the truth, that, you know, your economic system, your religious system, your political one, this is the truth, all others are silly, maybe it would be, the world would be better if they didn't exist, you know, this is very, very arrogant. And simply can't be objectively defended. Certainly you can say that some cultures, some societies have been more successful, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're more true. Free market economies have generated all sorts of wealth and success in Western countries. But left unfettered, if we do this for another few decades, this is not going to be to the benefit of the planet as a whole. So success doesn't necessarily mean truth. So what he spends a lot of the last part of the book talking about is the fact that when you get right down to it, every cultural system, every worldview is ultimately arbitrary and fictitious, which means that to a large extent, many, if not most human beings, get their sense of truth and meaning from systems that are not, in fact, truthful and meaningful. Now, maybe it would be okay if we just said, okay, we've figured this out, let's just not tell anyone. And let them go on. What he's saying, the problem is that where most people are getting a lot of their sense of meaning and truth, they're getting it from human-made aspects of the culture, these very arbitrary things, these artificial things. And it's going to lead them to be rubbed the wrong way when they encounter other groups of people whose views and values and systems are quite different from theirs, because those are going to be a direct existential threat to the cultural system that gives this person the sense that, yes, I can achieve some type of immortality, and yes, my life is truly meaningful and truthful. And this, according to Becker, is what generates all sorts of conflict historically all around the world between people who come from different cultural backgrounds, political backgrounds, religious backgrounds, what have you. So ultimately, he feels that to tie your sense of self-esteem and heroism to cultural constructs is not psychologically healthy and, in fact, leads to social neurosis.
It reminds me that many of us, and I don't believe that you are a part of the us of which I speak, those of us who grew up with the standoff between the United States and the Soviet Union back in the 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. How you might as well have been talking about two parallel universes.
Yes.
In terms of what we Americans valued, what we saw as meaningful, as opposed to what the Soviet Union saw as meaningful, and what gave them their sense of identity.
Right.
It's very, very fascinating.
Right, and this book was written during the Cold War.
Yeah.
And there are many indirect references to that conflict throughout the book.
Yeah, yeah. And my parents actually visited the Soviet Union in 1971. And for anybody listening, they were cleared by the State Department. they were there for a legitimate reason, actually. But they, what they brought back, what their stories of dealing with the people, just the people, the average everyday people that they met, was quite fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And how we can come up with such different ideas of what is meaningful, what is right, what is true.
Exactly.
It's amazing. If we can, let's take a bit of a detour. One of the things I wanted to ask you about how we become conscious of ourselves from infancy. What are the mechanisms that bring that about?
I am not entirely sure. That's a question that would be better asked to somebody who is in cognitive developmental psychology. The way that Becker talks about it in this book takes a very, very neo-Freudian approach to the whole thing in terms of the development of the ego. And I think that many of the ideas in that particular chapter probably would not be seen as holding much water nowadays in modern psychological science. But as far as how exactly the conscience, the sense of self-awareness develops, there are a number of different stage theories out there, people like Piaget and so on and so forth, But I'm really the wrong person to ask this question to.
You're allowed to be the wrong person on this program. I do it every week. If you're just joining us, by the way, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella. My guest today is Brian Baudel. He is a psychology professor here at Grand Valley State University. We're talking about the book, The Birth and Death of Meaning, An Interdisciplinary Perspective on the Problem of Man by Ernest Becker. You mentioned Freud just a second ago, and one of the things I find interesting, so much of what Freud has written has been overturned by successive generations of psychologists. What about the concept of the id, ego, and superego? To me, that still makes so much sense.
It makes a lot of sense, but I see it more as a metaphor than as an accurate description of the way the mind works. Nobody has discovered, for instance, any particular areas of the brain that correspond exactly to the id or the superego or anything like that. I think a lot of what makes this particular model of personality so appealing, so intuitive, especially to many people who are coming to Freud for the first time, is it resembles very much the old image of the devil on the one shoulder and the angel on the other, with the id being the devil and the superego being the angel. And then you've got your head stuck in between the two shoulders trying to figure out what's right. It just seems to very, very intuitive. It's not entirely wrong. There are a number of aspects of moral reasoning, moral psychology, are in terms of the reach of the brain devoted to them, in terms of cognitive processes, are quite distinct from what presumably generates some of the more primitive drives having to do with sexuality, aggression, so on and so forth, that can influence our behavior. But it's not as clean and pretty a picture as that model seems to suggest. And all of these things are, I think, much more interrelated. Freud got a lot wrong. It's brilliant writing. It's brilliant speculation. He got a lot wrong. Nobody believes in things like the Oedipus complex anymore or penis envy, some of the different fixations he talked about, the different stages of psychosexual development, which some listeners may remember from psych classes where you have the oral stage and the anal stage. Nobody believes that anymore, but he did get a number of things right. The importance, the incredible importance of the first few years of development. Freud was certainly right that that's probably the most formative period of our lives, even if we can't remember much of it. He was very much right about many of the defense mechanisms. He was very much right about the fact that a lot of what drives our behaviors is beyond our ability to become consciously aware of. He was very, very right about those things. And that's sometimes glossed over nowadays as people have tried to throw basically the baby out with the bathwater. Many psychologists want to rid the field of all mention, all memory of Sigmund Freud.
But really?
Yes, really. The pendulum has begun to swing back the other way. And now some of the ideas of his that were considered for a long time some of his wackiest thoughts, some of his least scientific thoughts, now some studies are beginning to suggest there might be a little more to that stuff than we've been willing to admit as a field was true for 3 or 4 decades.
You say that scientific studies
are
pointing in this direction. Does that mean that these concepts came to Freud more intuitively than scientifically?
I believe so, although he was a very, very keen observer of human nature and certainly unwilling to let other people's negative reactions sway what he was willing to ponder and write about. I think he was a brilliant individual personally. Very, very cynical given his own life and the times he was living. But I think that many of his observations, even if we can say they're intuitive, they were grounded in very, very keen observation of the human condition.
I seem to recall that all of the writing that he did on sex and its various manifestations, he led a very, very middle-class moral life.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Yes, he did.
Married to the same woman for X amount of years and it wasn't terribly adventurous.
Yes, he described himself as a Protestant in sexuality.
Brian, we were talking a little earlier about the importance of self-esteem. Is there any way we can connect that, the importance of self-esteem, with the concern that many people have today of instilling false self-esteem in kids? That is, everybody's a winner.
Mm-hmm.
You're so important. You are the most special person on earth. We didn't get that in generations before.
No.
You know, some of us, and I think, no, I think my... My mom was really good at self-esteem. My dad was pretty much more realistic.
Right.
Okay. And I think that they balanced each other out. But I know a lot of kids who grew up, and especially in generations before, like in my father's generation, nobody was special. You're an extra mouth to feed, for God's mm-hmm. sake. We can't wait till you get out of here. That's what I understand previous generations and our generation, the baby boomers, we got a little bit. But I think today, yeah, everybody's a winner. How do you think that that is going to affect the generation coming up?
I do worry, not as much as some people worry about it, but I do worry about this. You know, I grew up watching Mr. Rogers, and I have very fond memories of that show. I think that was a terrific show in many ways. And given maybe a half an hour of that every week or something like that, I think that's a very good thing for kids to get that kind of message. You're special, you're unique, and so on and so forth. I do think that starting in especially maybe the 1970s, 80s, this began to be taken too far overboard, and more so by schools than by parents, but it eventually spilled outwards. The whole self-esteem movement in schools was an outgrowth of some very genuine concerns when it came, of course, to children who were coming from more impoverished backgrounds and so on and so forth, not achieving as much academically. And how can we do this? Well, we're not getting the funding that we want. We can't spend as much money on this. We don't have the resources to do extra classes or provide extra materials. But some studies were coming out of the social sciences showing that there was a strong correlation between self-esteem on the one hand and academic performance, GPAs, test scores on the other. As anybody in the social sciences know, any of the sciences know, there's a mantra: correlation does not imply causation. Unfortunately, many people in the educational community threw that mantra out the window and said, ah, we know what's going on. It's because the kids from the middle and upper class backgrounds, because their self-esteem is going to be higher because of the way they're being raised and the advantages they have, that higher level of self-esteem is allowing them to do better in school. And so the idea is we want to boost all kids' self-esteem, and that should have positive impacts. It didn't, and subsequent research showed that really what was going on, there was a causal arrow, was in the opposite direction, and it's not surprising. The better your grades are, the better you feel about yourself, right?
Yes.
But that message continues to be lost. There are advantages to boosting self-esteem. It makes people happier. And it does provide them some resilience against obstacles in life. But there are drawbacks to boosting kids' self-esteem artificially too much as well. They're more likely to engage in risky behavior and feel that they won't really suffer any consequences. They're less likely to try hard when they are faced with adversity, whether it's a challenging test or something like that, because they're like, okay, I failed, but you know what? I'm still special. There have been studies doing this. Roy Baumeister has done a number of really interesting studies with kids at various age groups in the school system showing many surprisingly negative effects of self-esteem. Intriguingly, one of the things that's been found is that, well, you've probably heard this old bit of folk wisdom that low self-esteem is what causes bullying, right?
Yes.
That bullies have
right.
low self-esteem.
Yes.
Some bullies do, but they tend to be the exception to the rule. Most bullies have exaggeratedly high levels of self-esteem, but at the same time, they feel disrespected. And that's the magic combination in terms of creating bullying. A high level of self-esteem, you feel better than almost everyone else around you, but you also feel like nobody recognizes that you are being not respected in some way. When you think of the world's greatest bullies, historically speaking, people like Saddam Hussein or Adolf Hitler, these were not people with self-esteem problems.
That's true.
But they did feel they had to prove something.
Yeah. I remember growing up, because I was dumb as a stump. I was a very, very mediocre performer in grade school. But they tried to instill confidence in me by telling me that according to my IQ tests, and they never gave me a number, but they kept telling me, both the teachers and my parents, that I was capable of more, mm-hmm. that I had the innate intelligence, and that I just wasn't putting forth the effort. So I do I distinctly remember feeling that you know, I was okay.
Mm-hmm.
Still dumb as a stump. At least if you looked at my grades, that's what you would say. But at least I never felt that I was less than perhaps I was. So,
mm-hmm.
But no, there was no, especially from Dad, God bless him. He made sure I had a very realistic understanding of myself when Mom tried to fluff it a little bit.
Yeah. But self-esteem is a double-edged sword.
Sure.
And I don't think you can say that it's universally positive or universally negative. But I am troubled by some of the directions you've pointed out in our society right now, how we're trying to artificially instill and boost this in kids.
Brian, we're out of time once again, but I want to thank you so much. It's been such a fascinating conversation.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed this.
If you are just joining us now, we have been speaking with Dr. Brian Bodel, who is a professor here at Grand Rapids. This is Fred Stella. I've been speaking with Brian Bodel. He is a professor of psychology here at Grand Valley State University. We've been discussing the book, The Birth and Death of Meaning by Ernest Becker. Please join us again next week right here on Common Threads.